Mark 9, verses 2 through 8, the Transfiguration. Kaimata hemeras hex, paralambanai ha Jesus, ton Petron kai ton Jacobon, kai ton Ioannein, kai anaferai autus, eis arus hypselon, kai kat idean manus, kai metaphorothe emprosthen auton. And after 6 days, Jesus takes along, notice the present tense, Peter and James, or Jacob, and John, and takes them up into a mountain, a high one, by themselves alone, and metamorphothe, he changed before them. What I'm going to do is we're going to go through, and starting with this verse, we're going to talk about some of the grammatical points, then I'm going to come back and talk about some of the theological points. So first of all, let's observe that this after 6 days is a little bit unusual for the Gospel of Mark. He doesn't usually have precise indicators of time. If you look at, for example, 2 verse 1 or 4:35, these are very indistinct indicators, so this is a little bit odd. Then it says, kat idean manus. This is a kind of a double expression for privacy, by themselves alone. And then, most significant here, is this metamorphothe. Usually this will be translated something like, he was changed. But this is a perfect example of a passive used in an active but intransitive sense. Look at Fundamental Greek Grammar, chapter 24, section D. There's another one that comes up later on in this verse that's exactly like this. So this is active but intransitive. He changed. He changed in front of them, before them. Kai ta hematea autu egeneta stilbanta loika lian. Hoia gnafois epites geis u dinatai hutos loikanai. Note here first, you have his garments became shining white exceedingly. Ta hematia is plural. The verb is singular, egeneta. That's a kind of a classical construction to use a neuter plural, only with the neuter, though. Neuter plural and a singular verb. Then egeneta goes with stilbanta, and this is like a periphrastic participle with ain plus the participle. You have one of those with ain. This is much more common with ain in chapter 1, verse 22, where it says, for he was teaching ain didaskon. He was teaching them, exuding authority. And here it became shining white, exceedingly white. Then hoia is a relative pronoun, and it conveys type or sort, referring to the white. The sort that, the type that. A gnafois is a fuller. A fuller is a person who works cloth. And, you know, back in 2:21, it says that nobody puts a piece of unshrunk cloth on an old garment. Well, what is a piece of unshrunk cloth? The phrase there is rakus agnafu, agnafu, unfold. So a fuller worked with lye and pressure to cleanse clothing, and he would also put them out in the sun. But whatever his function was to make sure that the clothes were clean and also with this pressure, break down the rough fabric so that it would be flexible. But in this case, we're talking about cleansing things. So this was white, the sort that, hoya, a fuller on earth was not able so to whiten. Verse 4. Kai ofthe autois heleas sin moisai, kai esan siluntes to Jesu. And there appeared to them Elijah with Moses, and they were speaking with Jesus. Now, there is one of those periphrastic constructions, esan siluntes. Now, with the form ofthe, that's again an aorist passive indicative, just like metamorphothe was an aorist passive indicative, and it's also intransitive active. Not was seen by them. That's incorrect. Appeared to them. And there appeared, and who appeared to them? Elijah with Moses. I'm going to talk about that order here in just a second. And they were speaking aloud with Jesus. Now, laleo generally denotes public discourse, if it doesn't mean like chattering of birds or something like that. So that to get this straight in terms of the storyline, the three disciples should have heard the content because they were speaking openly or publicly. This wasn't just some kind of private secret conversation. Notice the last two words, to Jesu. Jesus has that odd declining where the dative is not Jesu, it's also Jesu. So to goes with Jesu. 5. Kai apokrithais ha Petrus legai to Jesu. And in response, Peter says to Jesus, note the present tense there again, which foregrounds this, Rabbi, kalon estin hemas hode einai, kai poiesomen trice skenas, soi mean, kai moisai mean, kai helia mean. So, and in response, Peter says to Jesus, Rabbi, teacher, I'll talk about that in a second, it is good, it is a noble thing for us to be here, and either let us make or shall we make three booths, for you one, and for Moses one, and for Elijah one. Let's take a look. Rabbi. Now, this is a Semitic noun, and it means literally my great one, Rabbah. And in all the uses that there are in the Gospel of Mark, and let me list some for you here. 10:51, 11:21, 14:45. Jesus is seen as special, just like here. Now, note that Mark does not translate this foreign word as he does so many others, like, for example, Talitha Kum in chapter 5, little girl, I say to you, arise, or Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani, my God, why have you forsaken me? He translates those. This he does not translate. Now, in his commentary, Joel Marcus observes that later this term became a common term for teacher, but that it's questionable whether that had actually developed by this time, that that's sort of a later development. And indeed, in the use in 11:21 and in 14:45 I talked about, you could render that, though, teacher. Now, Hillel and Shammai, who were two rabbis, were not addressed by this title of Rabbi. So it's indeterminate whether this is teacher or whether this is really like my great one, whether we should take it just like that. The hamas in this verse is accusative because it's the subject of the infinitive einai. It is good for us to be here, or it is good that we are here. Then I indicated as I was doing the basic translation, poi eisomen is interesting. That's a first person plural, aorist subjunctive active. It's an independent use of the subjunctive. It's not following hina or in association with on. So it's going to be either deliberative, shall we, or cohortative, hortatory, let us. So you could translate that, let us make three booths, or shall we make three booths? I think the deliberative is probably better, shall we make three booths, but you could go the other way. For a little discussion of this, see Fundamental Greek Grammar, chapter 28. Then notice the ordering of the personal pronouns at the end of the verse. This is pretty significant. Soi, for you one, and for Moses one, and for Elijah one. Not really one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah. So the emphatic position of that is, he is pointing these three guys out specifically. Right? For all of those of you who are manuscript geeks, it's at about this spot right here, that manuscript psi. It's actually beginning in the next verse. That manuscript psi comes online, and that is one of the chief good manuscripts for the Gospel of Mark. All right, verse 6. Ugar edai ti apokrithe ek phoboigar egenanta. Now, this first gar here is probably one of these Markan asides, just like you have in chapter 16, where it's talking about the stone being rolled away, and it says, for it was very large in verse 4, 16:4. Probably, you know it was very large, or here, you know he was not knowing what he should say. Eidai, let me talk about that form. Eidai is the pluperfect of oida, and it's the equivalent of an imperfect. He was not knowing. And then, now follow with this next construction. This is actually quite important. Ti apokrithe. That apokrithe is a third person singular, aorist subjunctive passive. And what it does is it reflects the original thought. This is sort of indirect discourse. He was not knowing what. See, knowing what works like said that. It's an indirect discourse construction. So what's the underlying thought here that he didn't know? Here's the underlying thought. What shall I answer? What shall I reply? That would be a deliberative subjunctive, and the fact that in the direct speech it would be deliberative subjunctive is reflected now in retaining the subjunctive. So that's why I'm translating shall with should like this. You know, he wasn't knowing what he should answer, reflecting the statement standing behind it, what shall I answer? Again, another gar, for he had become scared out of his mind. 7. Kaiagenata nephele episkiadzusa autois, kai egenata phone ek tes nepheles, houtas esten ha huias mu ha agapetas acuete autu. Translating first. And a cloud came on the scene. That's a good use of egeneta there. Came on the scene. Overshadowing them. Now, that's a tendent circumstance. It came overshadowing them. And a voice, egeneta, came from the cloud. This is my son, the beloved one, my beloved son. Hear him. Now, notice both of these egenetas. This is like appeared on the scene, or in the case of the voice, come, when it's not, what shall we call it, physical, geographical coming. In other words, not like the train coming, but you use come with egeneta, ginomai, in something like opportunity coming. So that's not physically making geographical progress at you. So a voice came from the cloud, appeared, came on the scene from the cloud. This is my son, the beloved one, my beloved son. Hear him. Now, I'm going to talk about this further in a few minutes, but I want you to notice that with this is my beloved son, the verbiage is similar to 111. But here, it's this is my son. In 111, it's you are my son. Now, this is the middle of the three affirmations of Jesus as the Son of God. 111, here in 9:7, and then again in chapter 15 by the centurion at the foot of the cross, who affirms him as the Son of God in 15:39. When it says, hear him, most commentators draw a parallel between these words and the verbiage of Deuteronomy 18:15. But in fact, these two passages are not identical if you look at the Septuagint verbiage. In fact, the Septuagint reads, autu akouseste, him you shall hear, with the future middle of akouo. There is an exact parallel in 1 Maccabees 2:65, and I'm going to talk about that further. Then finally, 8. Kai exapina periblepsamenoi uketi udena aidan. Allah, or the variant reading is I may, ton yesun monon methauton. And suddenly, looking around, or upon looking around, no longer nobody did they see. They no longer saw anybody. Here's Greek heaping up negatives again, with the exception of one particular construction. Negatives always heap up in Greek. They don't cancel out. They no longer saw anyone, we would say, except Jesus alone or only with themselves. Monon can be adverbial, Jesus alone with themselves. Now let's go back to the beginning of the pericope, and let's take a look at some of the more theological points here. First of all, verse 2, after 6 days. Now, what does this evoke? Well, several parallels. Moses ascended Mount Sinai after 6 days in Exodus 24:16. Creation was accomplished in 6 days, and then after 6 days, God rested, Genesis 1. But also, the beginning, Jesus' resurrection on the seventh day is the beginning of the new creation. And this may well be the direction in which we want to go. This third option, the beginning of the full implementation of the new creation. and you get a foretaste of this in the transfiguration, a foretaste of the resurrection. Now it says, he went into a high mountain. A mountain in the Old Testament is a place of revelation and encounter with God, especially for Elijah and Moses, both of whom are mentioned here, and both at Mount Horeb. Elijah, 1 Kings 19, and Moses, Exodus 19 to 24. Then it says, he changed. Metamorphothe. Now, this is actually fairly significant, because there's a different understanding betrayed here by, or not betrayed, exhibited here, with this kind of a verb and with this kind of a pericope. Up to this point, we've always had the proleptic coming of the reign and rule of God being kind of a foretaste in principle. Jesus heals some people, but he doesn't heal everybody. Jesus raises one girl from the dead. He doesn't raise everybody. It is a foretaste. Now another model is on the table, and that's the model of hidden reality. Now a different message is conveyed, and that is that the eschatological reign and rule of God is here, but completely, but hiddenly. It's not just incipiently. You just can't see it. It needs unmasking. In What Does This Mean, my hermeneutics book, this is described in Addendum 11b as kind of the second model. This is basically a Johannine model. John talks about signs, and Jesus kind of reveals himself that way. Well, that's what you get here. These models are not exclusive to any one gospel, and here you see a hidden reality model. The reality is seen here on the mountain. This takes us back to 9 verse 1, and 9 verse 1 is the predecessor, the verse right before this particular pericope. And 9 verse 1 says, truly I say to you, there are some standing here who will surely not taste death until they see that the kingdom of God is already come in power. Now, note my translation of that. Elelithuion, the perfect participle in predicate position after a verb of perception. Until they see that the reign and rule of God is already here in power. They see that in the transfiguration. So you might say the transfiguration is the fulfillment of the prediction in 9 verse 1. And it's some standing here. Well, who are the some? Well, it's Peter and James and John, and it's not the entire group of the disciples who get to see that the reign and rule of God is already there in power. All right, now in 9:3, we talk about his garments. His raiment became gleaming white. In his commentary, Joel Marcus observes that, and I hadn't really noticed this myself, that both Matthew and Luke say that Jesus' face was also changed. This, having the face change, draws a close parallel between Jesus and Moses, Exodus 34:29. Mark does not want to focus upon Moses in this pericope, but upon Elijah. Hence, he does not include this detail. And hence, in verse 4, it says that Elijah appeared with Moses. Next, the white garments. You have a parallel here with the young man with the white raiment in 16:5 at the tomb on Easter morning. White clothing here in Mark seems to signify, and I guess you could say be part of, a new dimension of existence within a fully revealed, fully implemented reign and rule of God. Therefore, this event now, this transfiguration, is an anticipation of the resurrection and of the new state that Jesus will occupy at that time when he is, so to speak, fully manifesting the new creation. As far as the Gnophois is concerned, the fuller and his work appear in Malachi 3:2 in the Old Testament. Malachi uses the simile to express, though, spiritual cleansing. The fuller's work produces a condition that's appropriate when God comes to visit his people. And this work is done in Malachi by the Lord, who is the messenger himself. So you might say that the cleansed nature of Jesus' garments should be seen as evidence of divine presence and divine action. They're beyond the fuller. Verse 4. You have the appearance of Elijah and Moses together, and this could be a portrayal of these figures as the key figures in the Old Testament revelation. Moses as the chief giver of the law, and Elijah as the quintessential prophet. Though you have to say, of course, Elijah was not a writing prophet. Now, it's better, though, to see both men as prophetic figures, not as representing the law and the prophets. It's actually the way Deuteronomy 34:10 portrays Moses as a prophetic figure. And it's how he, Moses, understands himself in Deuteronomy 18:15, a prophet like me. Both are associated also with later prophetic appearances in history. The oracle of Malachi says that Elijah the prophet will come before the great and awesome day of the Lord in Malachi 4:5. And Moses himself says that God will raise up a prophet like him, whom the people, him you shall hear, Deuteronomy 18:15. Seems to me, then, that Jesus' appearance with the two Old Testament figures says, on level 2, that these prophecies are fulfilled. That is to say, when these two prophetic figures would, if you might put it this way, appear again. Now, this idea of seeing Jesus as a prophetic figure, I think, is actually pretty key, and it's certainly key in Mark. Now, in Mark, Jesus takes on the role of Yahweh in 1:3, prepare the way of the Lord, the Son of God in 1:11, the Son of Man in 2:10, the King or Messiah in 8:29, Peter's confession, the Suffering Servant in 8:31, and the people of God themselves in 1:11, when he's called the Son. He is also a prophetic figure in Mark's gospel. As such, though, Jesus parallels Elijah more than he does Moses, because like Elijah, he calls people to repentance before the imminent arrival of the reign and rule of God in 1:14. In fact, on several occasions, Jesus is specifically linked to Elijah in Mark's gospel, 6:15 and 8:28, where he's identified with Elijah by outsiders. You know, who is this guy? Well, it could be Elijah. And 15:35, he's thought to be calling Elijah. Therefore, This is, I think, why Elijah is mentioned first in this account and not Moses. Peter's statement doesn't reflect what Mark is doing, and he has the more, I don't know, what would you say, conventional way of looking at this, and he mentions Moses first. Note also both of these figures from the Old Testament, Moses and Elijah, or I should say in this regard, Elijah and then Moses, had mysterious ends, Elijah being taken up in a whirlwind in 2 Kings 2:11, and Moses dying and being buried under unknown circumstances in Deuteronomy 34:1-6. So it's probably not surprising that the two men show up here once again. But we should notice that neither guy is transfigured on the mountain as Jesus is. Now, what were these two figures speaking with Jesus about? Well, it's not apparent. Luke says his exodus, but Mark does not say that, so don't go there when you're preaching this. Probably Mark's description here is intended to signify that all three men are on the same page and they are not apparitions in that kind of a sense. Now, what about the three booths in verse 5? Well, an immediate association is the Feast of Booths, which is a seven-day festival. You can see it described in Leviticus 23, 34 to 36, and also 39 to 43. It's also described in Numbers 29, 12 to 38, and in Deuteronomy 16, 13 to 15. Now, this is a seven-day harvest festival. We know that from Leviticus 23:39, in which people celebrated by taking branches and boughs of trees and putting them together to make these booths. Leviticus 23:40, they dwelled in these booths, 23:42. And what they were doing is they were commemorating the sojourning under God's guidance from Egypt to the land of Canaan. That's in Leviticus 23:43. Now, what's pertinent to the transfiguration scene are two factors related to the celebration of Sukkot, or the Feast of Booths, that were probably from about 200 years before Jesus. First, they use psalms in celebration, especially Psalms 113 to 118, which are songs of ascent. And Psalm 118 is a pretty important psalm for Jesus and for the Holy Week. Then they read Zechariah 14, 16 to 19, which describes the pilgrimage of all people to Zion to celebrate Sukkoth, the Feast of Booths. Now, the former, the Psalms, contains admonitions to tremble at the presence of the Lord, Psalm 114, verse 7. And the Zechariah reading is the basis for associating Sukkot with eschatological redemption. In other words, all the people come. So, this association of eschatological redemption would be easy for Peter to draw, and it'd be easy for him to make this connection, especially against our Lord's mighty works that he had done prior and the transfiguration. So you have kind of the celebration of Sukkot, the Feast of Booths, commemorating this coming of to coming to full fruition of the eschatological visitation. Now, note though, Peter, when he describes his proposal, he places Moses in front of Elijah, Not only that, he places Jesus on a par with them because he says one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah. He doesn't really distinguish them. And that may, we may see something of that in what comes next. And that's, let's go to verse 7 with the cloud. The cloud comes on the scene. Now, the cloud has great significance. In the Old Testament, you see, for example, in Exodus 19, 9 to 13, Exodus 24, 15 to 18, and in 34, 1 to 5, Moses ascending into the cloud on Mount Horeb. But also, in Exodus 33, 9 to 10, 40, 34 to 38, Numbers 9, 15 to 23, Deuteronomy 31, 14 to 15. This is the cloud with Yahweh's presence at the tabernacle. Probably this is what we have here. And probably the best parallel is to Exodus 40, 34, where the glory of the Lord is present in and in association with the cloud. So the cloud brings with it God's special presence, even as the Lord was present at the tabernacle in a special way. Now the acclamation. This is the voice that comes in verse 7. The acclamation, as the beloved Son recalls 1:11, as I said, where it addresses Jesus directly, but here it addresses the three disciples. This is my beloved Son, not you are my beloved Son. This is a direct affirmation of who Jesus truly is, and that in Jesus, and we can say in his ministry, the reign and rule of God is truly come with power, as we said in 9 verse 1. But now comes actually the most critical thing, and that is the command to hear him. Now, I want to spend a little time on this. There's a verbal parallel, akouete autou, present imperative, and then the autou is a genitive because in classical Greek and in better Koine Greek, verbs for hearing could take the genitive. The verbal parallel is not to Deuteronomy 18:15. The verbal parallel is to 1 Maccabees 2:65. Now, this is important because in 1 Maccabees 2:65, you have a transfer of allegiance, and that's exactly what you have here. In 1 Maccabees, old Mattathias commands his son, his sons, his children, to hear and obey Simon Maccabeus, Simeon in the Septuagint, from now on. And he says, hear him, with that present tense probably being a policy command. As a matter of policy, hear him. So, the voice from the cloud commands the three to hear and obey Jesus from now on and not the two major Old Testament figures. This is why the two figures disappear after the voice says this. They are no longer the people to be heeded. Jesus is. So this is just like the thought that the people of God are no longer the Jews. They are Jesus. There is no longer any other messianic figure, only Jesus. There is no other Son of God like the people of God, only Jesus. No other suffering servant, only Jesus. So he takes into himself. This is what one scholar has called in the Gospel of John, which does much of the same thing, the Christification of the Old Testament. So here's what we have. He is the prophetic figure. Hear him. So I guess, looking at some previous verses here, the due time is at hand, 1:15. New cloth and new wine are here, 2:21 and 2:22. The old must disappear. All right, so that's the first thing. Second thing with the hear him. Given Peter's statement in the previous verse, saying that it's favorable for the three to be there on the mount, and three booths might be constructed to celebrate the eschatological redemption that is in the Feast of Booths, the Feast of Sukkot, the voice now commands the three disciples truly to hear him. So now I'm not emphasizing so much hear him as I am hear him. Listen to the message which Jesus brings and that he's been trying to communicate to you. Remember, this is the beginning of chapter 9, and it's not so many verses before that we had the first passion prediction in 8:31. That's only like eight, nine verses before. The Son of Man must endure the cross, even as his own followers are subject to the cross, because suffering precedes glory and cannot be escaped. So this voice provides affirmation that the destiny of Jesus as the suffering servant, as described in 8:31, the Passion prediction, is part of the reign and rule of God come in power. You might say it's not an accident. Rather, it is he who is God himself, the very Son of God, the Son of Man, the Anointed One, coming to bring his people their eschatological visitation, in which he gives his life as a ransom for many, as he's going to say in 10:45. So to summarize this point, when it says, hear him, it is listen up to his description of his own mission, where triumph, yes, will be there, but only through suffering. Finally, let's go to 9:8. And we'll just say that there is an interesting comparison between this pericope and the short resurrection scene in chapter 16. Both contain a white robe figure, 9:3, 16:5, a voice that tells them something about this person, 9:7, 16:6, fear and people not speaking, 9:6, and 16:8, the women. Jesus manifesting the presence of the eschatological reign and rule of God. So you have in this whole thing and in 16:6, where you have the assurance, I guess let's use that, where it says here, see, he's not here. See the place where they laid him. And then in 7 also, he is going before you into Galilee. There you will see him just as he told you. Just as he told you. So in conclusion then, let's just say that this transfiguration provides a preview and a foretaste for all that of the resurrection and of the full implementation of the reign and rule of God. Thank you very much.